Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Mara Yudhisthira said, and he's talking to Vidura, who's just returned from pilgrimage. The battle of Kurukshetra is over. And Vidura is coming back not to re-engage in politics, not to re-engage in household life. He's already taken Vadaprastha. He's coming back primarily to save Dhritarashtra. So that's our background. Translation, Maharaj Yudhisthira said, "My uncle, do you remember how you always protected us, along with our mother, from all sorts of calamities? Your partiality, like the wings of a bird, saved us from poisoning and arson." So there's the word here, paksha chaya. Paksha means bird. Chaya means shadow. So in the shadow of a bird, Srila Prabhupada is translating as partiality under the wings of a bird. That's interesting that Srila Prabhupada inserts the word partiality. And that's what we're going to focus on here, the equality of a devotee and the partiality of a devotee. So in this purport, Srila Prabhupada is going to tell the story behind what Maharaj Yudhisthira is speaking about. He's speaking about Visha, poison, Agni Adehe, and fire, and then Vipad Gana, some various types of calamities. So let's go into the purport where Prabhupada tells the story. Due to Pandu's death at an early age, his minor children and widow were the object of special care by all the elderly members of the family, especially Bhishma Deva and Mahatma Vidura. Vidura was more or less partial to the Pandavas due to their political position. Although Dhritarashtra was equally careful for the minor children of Maharaj Pandu, he was one of the intriguing parties who wanted to wash away the descendants of Pandu and replace them by raising his own sons to become the rulers of the kingdom. Maharaj Vidura could follow this intrigue of Dhritarashtra and company, and therefore, even though he was a faithful servitor of his eldest brother, Dhritarashtra, he did not like his political ambition for the sake of his own sons. He was therefore very careful about the protection of the Pandavas and their widow mother. Thus he was, so to speak, partial to the Pandavas, preferring them to the sons of Dhritarashtra, although both of them were equally affectionate in his ordinary eyes. He was equally affectionate to both the camps of nephews in the sense that he always chastised Duryodhan for his intriguing policy against his cousins. He always criticized his elder brother for his policy of encouragement to his sons. At the same time, he was always alert in giving special protection to the Pandavas. All these different activities of Vidura within the palace politics made him well known as partial to the Pandavas. Maharaj Yudhisthira was referred to the past history of Vidura has referred to the past history of Vidura before his going away from home for a prolonged pilgrim's journey. Maharaj Yudhisthira reminded him that he was equally kind and partial to his grown-up nephews, even after the Battle of Kurukshetra, a great family disaster. Before the Battle of Kurukshetra, Dhritarashtra's policy was peaceful annihilation of his nephews, and therefore he ordered Purochana to build a house at Varnavata. When the building was finished, Dhritarashtra desired that his brother's family live there for some time. When the Pandavas were going there in the presence of all the members of the royal family, Vidura tactfully gave instructions to the Pandavas about the future plan of Dhritarashtra. This is specifically described in the Mahabharata Adi Parva 114. He indirectly hinted, the reason he did this is it was in public, "A weapon not made of steel or any other material element can be more than sharp to kill an enemy. And he who knows this is never killed." That is to say, he hinted that the party of the Pandavas was being sent to Varnavata to be killed, and thus he warned Yudhisthira to be very careful in their new residential palace. He also gave indications of fire and said that fire cannot extinguish the soul, but can annihilate the material body. But one who protects the soul can live. Kunti could not follow such indirect conversations between Maharaj Yudhisthira and Vidura. And thus, when she inquired from her son about the purport of the conversation, Yudhisthira replied that from the talks of Vidura, it was understood that there was a hint of fire in the house where they were proceeding. Later on, Vidura came in disguise to the Pandavas and informed them that the housekeeper was going to set fire to the house on the 14th night of the waning moon. It was an intrigue of Dhritarashtra that the Pandavas might die altogether with their mother, And by his warning, the Pandavas escaped through a tunnel underneath the earth, so that their escape was also unknown to Dhritarashtra. So much so that after setting the fire, the Kauravas were so certain of the death of the Pandavas that Dhritarashtra performed the last rites of death with great cheerfulness. And during the mourning period, all the members of the palace became overwhelmed with lamentation. But Vidura did not become so because of his knowledge that the Pandavas were alive somewhere. There are many such instances of calamities, and at each of them, Vidura gave protection to the Pandavas on one hand, and on the other hand, he tried to restrain his brother Dhritarashtra from such intriguing policies. Therefore, he was always too partial to the Pandavas, just as a bird protects its eggs by its wings. Maharaj Yudhisthira said, "My uncle, do you remember how you always protected us, along with our mother, from all sorts of calamities? Your partiality, like the wings of a bird, saved us from poisoning and arson." So we have that there were three brothers, half-brothers, the sons of Vyasadeva, begotten on behalf of Vichitravirya, who had died, Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and Vidura. And because Dhritarashtra was blind, although he was the oldest, Pandu became the king, and therefore the line of succession was to go through Pandu. When Pandu died, there was no one to rule. So therefore, Bhishma, who was prohibited from ruling, had Dhritarashtra be officially in charge of the throne until Pandu's sons could grow up. And Dhritarashtra superficially took care of the Pandavas. The saying here, Dhritarashtra was equally careful for the minor children of Maharaj Pandu. But actually, he was always trying to kill them because he felt that if he killed them, then his own sons would be the only ones left to inherit the throne. So this kind of political intrigue has gone on for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Somehow or other, trying to accumulate one's power, right? That's what we want in the world. We want power. We think that we gain happiness from an attempt to garner as much resources as possible. That's our way of thinking, right? We think that somehow or other, if I make a lot of endeavor for happiness, I'll become happy. But Prahlad Maharaj teaches the opposite. He says, in this material world, every materialist desires to achieve happiness and diminishes the stress, and therefore he acts accordingly. However, one is happy as long as one does not endeavor for happiness. As soon as one begins his activities for happiness, his condition of distress begins. Why? Because then one is always in anxiety. Dhritarashtra was always in anxiety, plotting and scheming. These are my friends. These are my enemies. Let me get my enemies out of the way, even though these enemies are my own nephews. And their father has died, and as their uncle, and as the interim king, I should be protecting them. But instead, he sees them as his enemies. Now, interestingly enough, until Yudhisthira grew up, Dhritarashtra had the power. And he wanted the power not so much for himself, which he already had, but he wanted it for his son. So this is illusion. Right? Swajana, these are my people. So this is our general mentality in this material world. And this is explained very nicely in the Bhagavad Gita, 12th chapter, about what is the mood of a materialist. See if I can... Yes, this is a purport to text 15, where Krishna is glorifying the devotees, he by whom no one is put into difficulty and who is not disturbed by anyone. That he is very dear to me. Prabhupada says here that generally a materialistic person becomes very happy when there is something for his sense gratification and his body. But when he sees that others have something for their sense gratification and he hasn't, he is sorry and envious. When he is expecting some retaliation from an enemy, he's in a state of fear. And when he cannot successfully execute something, he becomes dejected. So this is the mentality of Maharaj Dhritarashtra. And we can ask ourselves, to what extent is this my mentality? If I get something pleasing, do I become happy? When I see that someone has something that I don't have, do I become sorry and think, well, why don't I have that? When somebody is threatening me, or I'm expecting some harm is going to come for me, when I think someone is my enemy, am I fearful? When I try to do something and I fail, it doesn't work out the way I want, do I become dejected? I mean, I had to look at myself in light of this verse and purport and say, all of these things apply to me. When I get something that's pleasing, some good food, some money, some nice clothes, whatever, some good friends, I become happy. Oh, look what I've gotten for myself. When I see that someone has some power or authority or opulence or influence or something that I don't have, I become sorry and envious. It's interesting because I'm here with my grandchildren, and children are very transparent about these things. You know, when you get to be an adult, you learn to either hide these completely from others, or try to anyway, or try to mask it under something. You know, when we criticize people who have more than we do. So just like yesterday, the kids were planning on going to a friend's house, and their mother asked them to get, asked one of the children to get something together, and he said, why should I have to do it? What's everybody else doing? Why do they have more free time than I have? Why don't I have? So that's his enviousness and sorriness is open and transparent, whereas we try to cover it. Oh, that lousy temple president, my lousy boss, that lousy government, you know, right? How come my husband can just go out and do whatever he wants and I have to stay home with the children? And if we say, oh, you're envious? Oh, no, I'm not envious. Right? We cover it. But this is our mentality. I become happy when I get something I like. If someone else has some power or influence, some freedom, some facility that I don't have, I become sorry and critical and envious. If someone's attacking me, the other day I got an email from somebody who used to be my friend, who I would expect to be my well-wisher, attacking me, threatening me. I'm going to do this and that and this and that to your service and your preaching and so forth and so on. And I became afraid. I became afraid. Oh, no, somebody might hurt me. Right? So we become filled with fear. And when the things we do don't work out right, right? We spent so much time on some project or this or that, and it just doesn't come together the way we want, or it doesn't have the effect that we want. Nobody cares. Now, look at this thing I've done. Oh, yeah, so what? And then we become dejected. Oh, I can't do anything anyway. I'm just a failure. Nobody even cares. Nothing works out. I tried so hard for this. So this is Zarathustra's mentality. And as soon as we are trying for material happiness by manipulating the material energy, then this is what we're subject to. Now, you can see of all these things, only one of them was happy when I get something that I want. And how much am I in control of that? And we're just trying to manipulate the material energy to always have what we want. So that's exactly what Dhritarashtra is doing. And he's going so far as to kill people. This is, of course, explained in the 16th chapter. You know, he is my enemy and I have killed him. And my other enemy will also be killed. Now, most of us, at least no one I've met as far as I know, has gone through this process of hankering and lamenting and envy and fear, to the point that we're killing other humans. Again, as far as I know, I've never met a murderer face-to-face, but maybe I haven't didn't know it. But generally, we try to kill others in indirect ways. And it's so funny. Language in this purport. It's so funny. It says here that before the Battle of Kurukshetra, Dhritarashtra's policy was peaceful annihilation of his nephews. How do you peacefully annihilate someone? Prabhupada's talking about basically secret annihilation. So openly, Dhritarashtra pretended to be a friend, and secretly he planned all these intrigues. Let me send them to Varanavat. Let me send them to Varanavat, and there we will build a house made of highly flammable materials. We'll set it on fire, and it will look like an accident. So this was one of Dhritarashtra's intrigues. Of course, he had many other intrigues. He was involved in the gambling match. And these intrigues were plotted by Duryodhan and approved and executed by Dhritarashtra. So externally, the face of a friend, and secretly trying to kill. So we may not do that. We may not set the homes of our enemies on fire. We may wish that that would happen. Right? Sometimes when a person really becomes our enemy, we may think, oh, Lord, why don't you kill this person? Right? Maybe some of us have thought like that. Or do something, you know. I was dealing recently with one person who was harassing others, and the harassed person said, can't we have this harassing person being committed to a mental institution? And they actually were looking up how to commit them to a mental institution. So we may want to somehow neutralize our enemies, if not kill them. We may pray to Krishna, Krishna, can you please kill this person? Or can you please have this person transferred to, you know, the moon? Even in the history of ISKCON, there was one leader who wanted to send all the women in ISKCON to Australia. He was considering that the women were his enemy, just like the original Australians were all criminals, that the British sent all the criminals to Australia. So this one leader wanted to send all the women to Australia. We just had, I just got a letter from someone who wrote into the Indian edition of Back to Godhead. They read a Hindi translation of an article I wrote years ago about the installation of deities in the Fiji temple, and they were protesting that in the article there were photographs of women. And they were saying that the only person who should see a woman's face is her husband. We shouldn't have any photographs of women in Back to Godhead magazine. So this is actually what he needs to get rid of, is his own lust, not photographs of women. You can see this is the kind of person that should live in Saudi Arabia, where all the women wear bags over their bodies and no one has to see them. Anyway, so we're thinking, you know, let me get rid of my enemies in some way. Let me neutralize them. Let me use, you know, the four kinds of diplomacy to try to neutralize their influence. So we're always feeling some anxiety. How am I going to deal with my enemies? Suppose my projects don't turn out right. Why does this person have more than I have? So as soon as we try for happiness, Prahlad Maharaj says, we get distressed. Dhritarashtra was always in distress. Brief periods of slight happiness when you get what you want. That's all. You know, we're thinking, I'm going to arrange life to always get what I want, and therefore I'll always be happy. But the reality is, we rarely get what we want, and then it's temporary, and then we're always worrying about protecting it. Right? But that old song my mother used to sing from Porgy and Bess. Right? I have nothing. I've got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. I've got no home, got no car, got no family. Those who have plenty and plenty, they keep a lock on their door. They're always worried that somebody will get it while they're out getting more. What for? So this is the mood of Dhritarashtra. I don't have enough power. Let me get more. And even the power I have, I don't know if I can keep it. Can I pass it on to my son? Will it be in my line of the family eternally? What can I do? I'll kill my enemies. I'll do that. I'll do that. I'll do that. Now I can enjoy for a moment. Oh, but somebody else is coming to take it away. Oh, someone has something more than I do. That's not fair. And that's the state of their mind. And my dear friends, we can be in this state even so-called in Krishna consciousness. Even when performing bhakti externally, our mood can be exactly like this. We should remember Dhritarashtra was externally a pious person. He was a Vedic person. He was following the rules of Varnashram. He even saw Krishna face to face. Yet this was his mood. And he suffered throughout his life. His life was one unending tale of suffering. All right. How do we do this? How do we become really happy, right? Prahlad Maharaj says that we become happy as soon as we don't endeavor for happiness. This is called karma phala tyaga. We give up the fruit of our actions. We give up, what does this mean actually? we give up the fruit of our actions. We'll look at that in a moment. But let's look first of all at the result of giving up, the fruit of our actions. The result, Krishna explains in the 12th verse of chapter 12, is peace. He says, Chagat Chantir Anantaram. Chagat, renunciation. Chantir, peace, Anantaram, at the end. At the end of renunciation, one finds peace. And then what does Krishna say about peace? He says in 266, Ashantasya kuta sukham. Ashantasya, without peace, kuta, how can there be sukham, happiness? This is Dhritarashtra's position. Without peace, he cannot have happiness. How do you get peace? You get peace by tyaga. You get peace by giving up karma phala, the fruit of karma. What is the fruit of karma? Why does anyone perform actions? To get swarga, to get heaven. Either heaven on earth or heaven on a higher planet. This is what Dhritarashtra is trying to do. Dhritarashtra is trying to achieve heaven. He's trying to become like an Indra. He's attached to this karma phala. Therefore, he has ashantasya. Therefore, he is a person with no peace. And then kuta sukham. He cannot have any happiness. When we give up this desire, when we give up this desire for material sense gratification, then the result of that is peace. Now, there's two ways explained in chapter 12 that one can give up this desire for karma phala. One Krishna recommends and one he doesn't recommend. The first way, which he doesn't recommend, is working for self-purification, working for liberation, working for realization of the self, and maybe Brahman or the Paramatma. So one is thinking, I'm doing my work. One's still working. One does not stop working. One does not stop acting. You see, his vidura is also acting, but he's acting in peace. One acts, but one acts for purification. One is thinking, I am serving my husband to become purified of my material desires. I'm going to a job to become purified of my material desires. I'm doing these activities because these are the activities enjoined in the Shastra. And I'm offering the result as a sacrifice. So on the unrecommended path, one is offering them as a sacrifice to realization of the self. On the path Krishna recommends, one is doing it to Krishna. One is offering these things as a sacrifice to Krishna. This is very nicely explained. In the purport to chapter 12, text 11. And also in chapter 11, text 55. Where Srila Prabhupada says that one should work to satisfy Krishna and then enjoy all the results as prasada. So what does this mean? Very simple. Just like if you work for a company, say you work for a business, and let's say it's a business that you're really inspired about. This business is doing something that really inspires you. You're not exactly working there for money. You're working there because you're dedicated to the cause. And then whatever salary you get, you just accept as mercy. You're not really working for the salary. I mean, I think many of us have done this in the Hare Krishna movement, where we have worked for some mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of Srila Prabhupada, and whatever facility we get in exchange, we accept as the mercy of Guru and Krishna. So we work on some project, and we get a place to sleep. We get something nice to eat, we get some clothes to wear, we get some good friends, and so forth and so on. Maybe we get a trip to India, and we accept that as mercy. That's not why we're doing it. We're not thinking, well, I'm going to go on book distribution all day, or I'm going to work on this book, or, you know, I'm going to dress the deities so I can have a place to sleep and something to eat. We're just inspired. I want to help dress the deities. I want to cook this food for Krishna. I want to distribute these books. We're not doing it for our own heavenly facility. and whatever facility we get, heavenly or not heavenly, and then we're grateful. We're very grateful. This is, of course, we do this in cooking, that we cook something for Krishna. We're thinking, what will Krishna like? And then we also get to eat the prasadam, and we eat the prasadam also as an act of worship, as gratitude. So one who does everything like this, every single thing one is doing, I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm doing this for Krishna. Bhakti Ram Yagatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshram Suradam Sarvabhutanam Yatramam Shantim Vichiti. Krishna is the enjoyer of what I'm doing. All my sacrifices are for his pleasure, and he is my best friend. Whatever he arranges for me as is his mercy. And therefore I'm satisfied in any circumstances, because my satisfaction is coming from Krishna's pleasure. My satisfaction is not coming from my own arrangements. And why do I find peace? Because I trust that whatever Krishna arranges for me is good. I read something wonderful the other day, that in the end, everything will be okay. So if it's not okay, it's not the end. So the devotee has this faith that ultimately everything is good. And if I perceive it is not good, then I'm just not perceiving the end. It was really interesting. I was watching a video of Steve Jobs, who recently died. He was glorifying how he would take prasadam at the Hare Krishna temple when he was a student. He also said, very interesting, he said, when you're doing things, you can't connect the dots. It's only when you look backwards that you see how everything fits together. And you have to work with that kind of faith. So the devotee has that kind of faith, that everything is going to fit together. As Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, God is all good, God is all merciful. Suradam, Krishna is my dear friend. You know, in this world, if I work to please my husband may or may not take good care of me. If I sacrifice everything to please my husband, or my wife, or my boss, or my children, or my family, or my society, first of all, they may not be pleased, and second of all, they may not take good care of me. But if I sacrifice everything to please Krishna, and I find my happiness is Krishna's pleasure, then I don't have to worry about how much money I will have, where I will sleep, what I will eat, what I will wear. And therefore I'm peaceful. Now, how does peace manifest? If you're peaceful, how does it manifest? It manifests in certain qualities of devotion, which are present in Vidura and absent in Dhritarashtra. And these qualities, we could say the specific manifestations of peace. Now, if someone could say, well, they're all peaceful. So Krishna explains exactly what does a peaceful person think, what does a peaceful person feel, what does a peaceful person do. Now let's go through this. One who's not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities. He does not think himself a proprietor. He's free from false ego. He's equal in both happiness and distress. He's tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled. Engage in devotional service with determination. He by whom no one is put into difficulty. He is not disturbed by anyone. He is equal posed in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety. In other words, there may be happiness and distress in the mind. There may be fear and anxiety in the mind, but the devotee is always detached, knowing I'm not the mind. Not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, pure, expert, without cares, free from all pain, not striving for some results. But the only result the devotee strives for is to please Krishna. Prabhupada says here, a devotee never takes the side of a particular party. One who neither rejoices nor grieves, who neither laments nor desires, who renounces auspicious and inauspicious things, equal to friends and enemies, equal poise in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, who's always free from contaminating associations, climate, satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, fixed in knowledge, engaged in devotional service, making Krishna the supreme goal of life. So these are the qualities of a devotee achieved by peace. And after, because of achieving these qualities, one can think of Krishna. Prabhupada explains this very nicely in his purport to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, 13, 14. All these qualifications enable him to fix his mind and intelligence entirely on the Supreme Lord. Manmana bhava madbhakto, majaji manmanasri. Manmana bhava madbhakto. To always fix one's mind upon Krishna. Yam yam bhapi saram bhavam. To remember Krishna at the time of death. That's what we're all looking for, right? To always be absorbed in Krishna. One can only do that if one has peace. And the way you tell if you have peace is the qualities that we listed. How do you get peace? You get peace by doing everything for Krishna, even if you can't yet think of him. And this is what Krishna describes in 12:10. You do everything for Krishna and you don't try to enjoy the results. You do everything for Krishna following the angas of bhakti. Your enjoyment comes from the fact that you're pleasing Krishna. You don't try to get enjoyment from manipulating your external circumstances. You are peaceful and satisfied with Krishna for that. Then you develop these good qualities, which Madhura exemplifies. Then you can always think of Krishna. Otherwise, always thinking of Krishna is not possible. In fact, we can say, then you can practice to always think of Krishna. Because the next step, after working without fruitive results, after working only for the satisfaction of Krishna by hearing chanting, etc., is that one can perform Abhyas Yoga or Sadhana Bhakti. Sadhana Bhakti is performed with the mind, where one is constantly bringing one's mind back to the name, form, qualities of Krishna. Krishna with the soft blue lotus feet, pinkish underneath, and the ankle bells, and the glowing golden swaying dhoti, and the beautiful golden sash, and the glimmering emerald-like nipples on his mirror-like form, playing his sweet flute with his delicate fingers, covered with rings, with three lines on his belly, tied it by Mother Yasoda, and lotus eyes and swinging makara, Capricorn earrings reflecting off of his cheeks. One, in order to even practice having the mind brought back to Krishna. Idam, we're singing now Dhammadarasika. Idam Tengu Kamboja Matkan Kamilai. Ritam Kundalai Snigarakcha Tripopya. Muhushkam Vitam Gumbarakta Dharamno. Manas Avirastam Alam Lakshavabai. Manas Avirastam Alam Lakshavabai. Let me always have this vision of your soft, curling hair surrounding your cheeks, which are kissed by the gopi, Madhya Soda, or Srimati Radharani, and therefore become reddened like the bimba fruit. So even to practice doing that with the mind, one first has to be peaceful. What to speak of actually doing it fully with the mind, maya shakta mana partha. One has to be peaceful, and the only way to become peaceful is to give up the results of one's activities and do everything for Krishna, or do everything for self-purification, although that's not so recommended. And then the result is that one has these peaceful qualities. So here in today's verse, we're seeing how Vidura has these qualities. But very interesting. So interesting. Vidura is certainly equal. Prabhupada is describing Vidura here in two opposite ways. How he's partial to the Pandavas. And yet, both the Kauravas and the Pandavas, Prabhupada said, were equal. He was equally affectionate. Vidura did not see friends or enemies. This, again, is the evidence of peace. These qualities, like Vidura have, this is the evidence of peace. But what does it look like? Vidura looks partial. He's chastising Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra. He's protecting the Pandavas. He's thwarting the plans of Dhritarashtra by speaking in code to Yudhisthira and going in disguise to Varnavata to save the Pandavas. When everyone is mourning, cheerfully mourning, Brahman says. That was so funny, this purport. So many funny things in this purport. Cheerfully mourning, Dhritarashtra's company, while they're cheerfully mourning the so-called death of the Pandavas, Vidura is secretly not mourning. He doesn't reveal to anyone that the Pandavas are alive. So he's acting so partial here. just like the bird under its wings. Pakshachaya. Sheltering its own eggs. It's not sheltering the eggs of some other bird. You know, there are some birds, they call it cowbirds, I think. They put their eggs in the nest of another bird. They don't raise their own children. They give their children up for adoption. And their own egg hatches earlier, and it shoves all the other birds out of the nest, and then the bird in whom the egg is in their nest, they take care of someone else's bird, they take care of someone else's egg, right? Secretly. So Vidura seems to be acting secretly here. Sheltering, giving shelter to the Pandavas, not giving shelter to the Kurus. But actually, he's equal. One may think, well, I don't want to attain this non-duality. Goodness, you know. And actually, I believe it's Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in his purports on the 12th chapter. He also brings up this point. He says, well, does that mean that there won't be any pain if somebody punches me? Does that mean if I taste something good, I can't express or feel any satisfaction with it? I mean, am I just going to be like kind of a blank slate? Sure, whatever happens to me is okay. It's like I tell my grandchildren, you have to respect your parents. They say, does that mean I have to do everything they say? So our mind doesn't want us to take up this path of detachment and peace because we're afraid that if we become peaceful, you know, we'll become like a chair. I mean, a chair is pretty peaceful. You know, if you polish it or you put dirt on it, you can put stool on it. You can put poop on it. You know, the chair doesn't protest. It doesn't matter to the chair whether you polish it or you dirty it. It doesn't matter to the chair whether you keep it in a nice, comfortable room or you put it outside. It's peaceful. The chair gives shelter alike to friends and enemies. Says, well, that's what I have to do. Trinada, peace, and uchina. Taror, evasta, hishina. You know, the tree, when the tree's thirsty, it doesn't ask for water. When you cut it, it doesn't protect. Do I literally become like a tree? I mean, there are people who've done that. Mahavir. Mahavir, who really started the Jain religion. I mean, it had existed before that, but he was the one who really got it going. And that's what he did. I think it was 13 years, where he traveled like a dumb person. Of course, Rishabhdev did the same thing. And interestingly enough, Vidura actually did the same thing when he and Dhritarashtra and Gandhari and Kunti actually retired at the end to the forest. But this Mahavir, what he did, or Jed Barrett also, he just didn't react. There's one story about how Mahavir got a thorn in his eye, and he just didn't react. And later someone found him and moved it, and he didn't react. Just no reaction. Basically being entranced. You know, if someone's in a deep yogic trance, they don't react to the external world. Pratyahara, they're withdrawing their senses like the turtle. Like Shamakarishi, he didn't hear Maharaj Parikit asking for water. So, okay, that's very nice if I'm sitting in meditation and I'm seeing Krishna's leelas manifested in my heart, but am I supposed to go through life like this? Am I supposed to wander around naked like Rishabhdev and people are urinating on me and throwing excrement at me and insulting me, and I'm just kind of dumb? Is that what it means? Can mean that. But we find that those sort of examples are very rare. That's the avidyuta who retired from the world. And the person who attains full peace actually can live like that. Krishna says they have no need to do anything. But he also says they have no need to give up doing anything. And that he actually requests his devotees, even at that stage of peace, to work in the world because yadyada tarachi is raised up. Because whatever a great man does, other men follow. So how is Vidura showing his equipoise nature towards friends and enemies? He's doing it, and Prabhupada says this directly. Right? Okay, let's see. He was equally affectionate to both the camps of nephews in the sense that he always chastised Duryodhan for his intriguing policy against his cousin. Okay, so his equal affection was manifested Prabhupada says, by chastising Duryodhan and protecting Yudhisthira. How is that equality? Because that's what they both needed. If you have one, you know, the older child hitting the younger child, protecting the younger child and correcting the older child is good for both. Why are you correcting the older child? Not just to save the younger child. You might be able to save the younger child by just removing the older child. But you're correcting the older child for the good of the older child. You know, when I'm instructing I instructed my children, my students, and now my grandchildren, so I say to them, I'm telling you this so that you can become a happy person. So that's also favor. That's also love. Why bother to correct somebody if you don't care about them? I remember one time I went to one lecture of Krishna Katha, and I went there not because I was interested in hearing that particular speaker, but I went there out of politeness and regard for some of my friends. And the speaker said some rather unusual and strange things. And in the car on the way back, we were discussing it, and someone said, do you think that that's right? I said, no, I think what the person said was wrong. And my friend said, well, why didn't you ask? I said, why do you think I didn't ask? And they said, because you really don't care. I said, yeah, it's a fact. I really don't care. It doesn't matter to me. So if we don't care about something, we don't correct it. Okay? We correct because we care. Of course, sometimes we may correct out of envy. That's another thing. But Vidura was correcting Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana because he loved them. In fact, he loved them as much as he loved the Pandavas. So we don't have to be afraid that equality means that I have to become like a chair, that peace means like a chair. We're so afraid of giving up this endeavor for happiness. If I give up the endeavor for happiness, I won't be happy. But it's exactly the opposite. If I give up trying to be happy independently, if I work instead to please Krishna, and I'm satisfied with whatever Krishna gives me as prasadam, then I will attain peace, which is the foundation of happiness. In that peace, I will be detached from my external situations. I'll become free. I'll no longer be controlled by my external situations. If people honor me or dishonor me, praise me, blame me, become my friends, become my enemies, if it's hot, if it's cold, if there's a nice place to live, there's not a nice place to live, if it's whatever, my happiness will be independent of that, because my happiness is then dependent on whether or not Krishna is pleased. Then I will manifest those qualities of detachment, equilibrium, neutrality, which means that I may still act in the world apparently partial. It may look like partiality, but my mood will be detachment and freedom. From that point, Madhvakim Labhate Param, from that point, I will be able to control my mind and always bring it back to Krishna when I'm chanting. And at that point, I will be able to remember Krishna while I'm cooking, while I'm cleaning, while I'm working. I have to first give up this karmapala. Even if I'm not a devotee, I've got to do it that way in order to attain peace. There's no alternative. There's just no compromise. It's not that one can't have sense gratification, but one can't be working for sense gratification. It's not that one can't even enjoy sense gratification, but one enjoys sense gratification as Krishna's prasad, with detachment, because one equally enjoys sense difficulty as Krishna's prasad. From there, Krishna explains, one can get the ability to practice thinking of Krishna, which after practice becomes easy and natural, and one will automatically always think of Krishna. And then one is happy. One is even happy at the preliminary stage of peace. What to speak of being happy by thinking of Krishna? So why am I working? Where is my attachment? It's not a question of giving up attachment, but transferring attachment. transferring my attachment from Kartha Hanuti Manute. I'm the doer. I'm doing this so that I can enjoy the world. Which gives me what? Anxiety. Two, I'm doing this so Krishna will smile. I'm doing it so Krishna will be happy. Whatever the results, victory or defeat, gain or loss, happiness or just doesn't matter. I'm doing it so Krishna will smile. Like the soldier. The soldier's serving for the pleasure of the country, for the pleasure of the king or the president. Whether they come back from the battle injured or not, whether they play a pivotal role in the battle or not, whether they're given a medal or not, whether the battle is won or not. People are recognized as loyal soldiers and heroes, even in lost battles. The soldiers on the losing side, they get a hero's welcome too. Win or lose, that's the business of Krishna. And when one works in that consciousness of me, Krishna says, one is never lost to Krishna. So this is our choice, Vidura or Dhritarashtra, who do we want to be? We must choose. There's mercy in knowing about these things, but you know, the choice is ours. This is not some magic, you know, someone's going to touch me on the head or whatever. I have to make the choice. Where's my attachment? In everything I do, where's my attachment? My own happiness or Krishna's happiness? Simple, small difference, small change, very small change that makes a huge difference. Vidura was always happy, and he had equal love for everyone. He saw every situation as auspicious. So that is where we want to go. That is where we want to go. And apparently we may look like anybody else. Vidura looked like a mean, conniving, spying, partial politician. But that was not his consciousness at all. His consciousness was detachment, material detachment, material neutrality, peace, and great attachment, loving attachment in the swirling emotions of a devotee association. Questions, comments?
Okay, I've unmuted everybody on pre-conferencing. So if you have any questions or comments, go ahead.
Mother Irma, if we take stock of our own self, go inward, as you were saying, and look to see, do I also have these qualities that we see in Dhritarashtra? We see, oh my God, I do feel envy, and I do experience material jealousy. What do we do about it?
Okay, so this is a very good question. So I look at myself and I see, you know, go through, I'd really suggest, take the Bhagavad Gita, it'll take you 3 minutes. I read it here in the class, but go through it again. Take the Bhagavad Gita and read through chapter 12, verses 13 through 20. And see, do I have those qualities? Or do I have the qualities as described for Dhritarashtra, which was in what book was that in? That's in 15. So if you read the purport to 12:15, which I also read in this class, the qualities of Dhritarashtra, do I have those qualities? Which do I have? So if I have the qualities of Dhritarashtra, that means that I'm doing my work for some result, for some heavenly result. If I have the qualities Krishna describes in the verses, then I'm doing my work to please Krishna. It's really simple. Those are the symptoms. I can think I'm doing my work to please Krishna, but I can tell. Because the effects will be of the peace that I will have will be demonstrated in those qualities. Now, what do I do about it? It's a very small, small, small switch. That whatever I'm doing, and this is described very nicely, if you want to look at it in detail, described very nicely, Brahma Samhita, text 61. It's also very nicely described in the purport of text 10. And to some extent also text 11 of chapter 12, and particularly in chapter 11, text 55 of Bhagavad Gita. And there's many other places, but those are the places I'm looking at right now. Basically, what you're doing, you're thinking, I'm doing this for Krishna. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about, in his form of a gopi, how whatever service he's being given by the other gopis, he does it with great care, even if it's a very small service. I know I bring this up a lot, but it's just such a simple thing. It's something anybody can do. Prabhupada writes this better to Jayapataka Swami. Surrender means I do my service carefully for Krishna's pleasure. So let's take something that you do during the day. Give me something, anything. Narahari, what's something you do during the day? Hello, hello?
You know what? I think he dropped out. I'm sure he'll be back momentarily, but it looks like he just dropped out, that sound that you just made.
Oh, no. All right, well, somebody else, give me something you do during the day.
Correspondence.
Huh? Correspondence. Okay, so we're answering our mail. We're writing letters, we're answering our letters. So in Goloka Vrindavan, also, the residents are carrying messages. There are gopis and cowherd boys and servants who carry messages back and forth from Krishna to Radharani, from Radharani to Krishna, from Radharani to her friends, from Krishna to his friends. And they may carry messages in writing. They may carry messages verbally. We find that Krishna is asking people to carry messages. Krishna asks Uddhava to carry a message to the Pandavas. Of course, Rukmini asked the Brahmana to carry a message. So there's so many instances in Krishna Lila where messages are being carried. So I can get in that mood. I'm one of Krishna's servants. I may not yet know who I am, but in a general way, I'm one of Krishna's servants. And is that Narahari back again?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry.
We lost you. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm giving an example of something we do during the day and how we can do it in the consciousness to get those qualities. So Ramananda said, just like answering correspondence. So one can think about how in Krishna's Leela, there are many people who are writing and carrying messages. So we can think, I am writing letters and carrying messages to please Krishna. I'm in Krishna's pastimes. We are in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes right now. We may not see him manifest before us, but we are in his pastimes. And when I'm answering my correspondence and sending letters, however I'm sending them in the mailbox or whether I'm carrying them in my hand or over email, I'm carrying messages for Krishna. I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm doing this to bring forward Mahaprabhu's Leela. I'm doing this so Krishna will be happy. Just like Rukmini, she sent the Brahmin with that message to Krishna. And when the Brahmin came back, and she could understand that he had brought Krishna, she was so happy that she offered her very self to that Brahmana. She offered obeisances to that Brahmana, which means the Brahmana became fabulously wealthy because she's the supreme Mahalakshmi. And he accepted such as the prasadam of the Lord. So that's what we're working for. Did the Brahmana carry the message thinking, oh, if I carry this message, this means he's going to give me a lot of money? Was that what he was thinking? Hello? Anybody there?
Irmila, I'm sorry. We try and be quiet, so it takes a minute to respond.
Okay. When the Brahmin took the message to Krishna and brought Krishna back, was he doing it thinking that he was going to make a lot of money?
No.
Why was he doing it?
As a service to Krishna.
What was his goal? What did he want to achieve?
Krishna's pleasure.
Yes. Did he want Krishna to be pleased with him specifically?
No, he was an agent.
Yes, he did. No, he wanted Krishna to be pleased with him. This is explained in Krishna book with Akura. That Akura was going to see Krishna, and he wanted to be recognized by Krishna. He wanted Krishna to say, Uncle Akura. And Prabhupada says, if we don't work to be recognized by Krishna, our life is condemned. So this Brahmana was carrying the message, so Krishna would be pleased with him. That he wanted to be an instrument of uniting Dwarkadish Krishna and Rukmini, uniting Krishna with his pleasure energy. Giving Krishna pleasure. Giving Krishna pleasure means uniting Krishna with his pleasure energy. Hare Krishna. And we want that we are the instrument, that we are the catalyst for uniting Krishna with his pleasure energy. And the Krishna is therefore pleased with us. That's what we're looking for. My daughter just played Jatila in a play. She was saying it's very hard to play Jatila because she's apparently the enemy. But Jatila also acts to bring Radha and Krishna together. So everyone is acting to bring Sita Ram, Radha Krishna, Rukmini Krishna. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to give pleasure to Krishna. And we want to be the instrument of that. Then we also enjoy their pleasure. In this world, you know, we take pleasure. I mean, unless you're a brahmacharya sannyasi, we take pleasure in seeing our friends get married. And if we were an instrument, you know, if we introduced our friend to the person, we feel very happy. Somehow, if we're there, if we're an instrument of their happiness, that's what Krishna asked Arjuna to be. Be my instrument. Be my instrument for my pleasure. So if when I'm answering correspondence, I'm thinking, wow, Krishna has given me something to do. Prabhupada writes about this. He said, everyone should think that they have been engaged in a certain occupation by Rishikesh, the master of the senses. Krishna has given me this to do. Krishna is asking me to answer this correspondence as part of his plan, as part of his mission. It may be a very little service. I may not really see how answering my letters today, you know, works into the greater mission of the Lord. But I have trust that if he's given me this job to do, it must be important to him. Let me do it in the most first-class way possible. Let me pay attention to the details, as Prabhupada writes to Jayapataka Swami. And what am I hoping? I'm hoping that Krishna is smiling at me. I want Krishna to smile at me. Jesus talks about this in the parable of the talents. How the master leaves 10 coins, 5 coins, and 1 coin each with 3 servants. And when he comes back, the servant who had 10 coins got it to 100, invested it, became 100. The servant who had 5 coins invested it and doubled it to 10. The servant who had 1 coin buried it in the ground because he thought he had a mean master. And to the servant who doubled what they were given, the master says, well done, O good and faithful servant. So that's what I want to hear. That's my mood. So I'm answering my correspondence so that Krishna will say, well done, good and faithful servant. That's my phala. That's my fruit that I'm working for. Now, material fruit, I'm answering my correspondence so people will think that I'm a reliable person, I'm a responsible person, they'll like me, they'll be my friend, they'll invite me over and feed me. You know, I'll have some community, I'll have some respect, or I'm doing it so I can defend against my enemy. You know, I'm answering correspondence if someone's accusing me of something or they're doing something that's going to hurt me and I'm defending myself and I'm protecting myself, or I'm answering my correspondence because I'm arranging to get money or I'm arranging to get facility. So what am I doing? Am I answering my correspondence thinking, I am the doer. And I am doing all these things to manipulate the material energy and other people to get what I want and avoid what I don't want so I can feel powerful. Ishwarahamaham Bodhi. Or am I answering this correspondence because it's somehow or other part of Mahaprabhu's Leela so that Guru and Gauranga will look at me and say, well, while I'm doing it, not future, I want that Guru and Gauranga, they're looking at me now while I'm answering my correspondence and saying, well done, good and faithful servant. No matter how it turns out. No matter how what the result is, that's my master's business. I'm an employee. So that's how you do it. While we're doing everything, even using the toilet, even brushing our teeth, going to get the mail, everything. I'm doing that so that Guru and Krishna will say, at that time, not a year from now, not 10 years, now, that they're looking at me now, well done, good and faithful servant. I'm not doing it to make some nice position for myself in this world, either now or in the future. I'm very focused on now, and I'm very focused on pleasing Krishna now, with what I'm doing and the attitude that I'm doing. If I do that, I attain peace, and through that peace, I can always meditate on Krishna. Is that clear? It's actually very simple.
It's clear, and I like it, but it makes me wonder, is there then I'm sure there isn't, so I'm interested to hear your answer, that it would seem like maybe there's like a, it would appear to be like a slight compromise in selflessness, where we talk about a high tukiya pratiyata, you know, totally unmotivated. It would seem like there's maybe a slight motivation in there to get, you know, a wink from Krishna, or that they, you know, something for us out of it, rather than total selflessness. I'm simply concerned for Krishna's pleasure, whether Krishna handles me, you know, roughly by his embrace, tramples on me. I don't care anything for myself. I simply want everything for Krishna's pleasure.
You can't
not
start
looking
at
for
the
that.
Goal, Prabhu. You know, if our situation right now is that I have the mood of Dhritarashtra, then you can't jump to being at prema. I mean, you can in a moment, but, you know, that's not the steps.
Got it.
So, yes, of course, in the beginning, and actually, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains this in Madhurya Kadambini, how selfishness and desire for Krishna's pleasure decrease gradually and proportionately as one advances. But the pure devotees are looking for Krishna to say, well done, good and faithful servant. That's what they're living for.
Hmm.
Prabhupada explains that with Akura, and he also explains it with the gopis, that the gopis just want to see Krishna smile at them because of them. I want to be the, that's how I find meaning. That I have contributed to Krishna's happiness. Otherwise, ultimately, it's impersonal. There is still me. Bhakti is, there is still the bhakta. There's bhakta, bhakti, and Bhagavan.
Hmm.
I want Krishna to be happy with me. Yes, I do.
That's
why?
Sweet. I like that.
Because that's what he wants. So, you know, for the beginner, I want Krishna to be happy with me because I think that will make me happy. Okay. If that's where we are, that's where we are. But at least I figured out what Prabhupada calls my real self-interest. So I start from there. I can't start from where I'm not. I mean, I just can't. Just like I'm going to be flying in a week, exactly a week, in fact, from here to San Diego. But I can't fly from here to San Diego. There's no plane that flies from Hilo to San Diego. I have to go through Honolulu. If I try to go from here to San Diego, guess where I'm going to end up? In the ocean. There's no plane. I'd have to start flapping my wings, you know, I'll just drown. So if Hilo happens to be my starting place, I have to go to Honolulu first. I don't have an option. Or I could go to LA first. There is a flight from here to LA. But the point is, I have to go to an intermediary step. I just have to. And there's no use lamenting about it. Just is what it is, what it is. Now, I could go through the intermediate step very quickly. I could have a very quick layover in Honolulu or LA. You know, it's my choice. Do I want to stay in Honolulu for, you know, a week? Or do I want to stay in Honolulu for an hour? But still, I have to start from where I am. But even the pure devotees, they want Krishna to be happy with them because that's what makes Krishna happy. I mean, those of you who are parents, or we're all children of some parent, the parent wants to be happy with the child. So the child works hard to get an A in school to make the parents happy. The parents want to be happy with that particular child. The parent just doesn't want to be happy just kind of in general. Why does a parent have a child? Prabhupada often explains this as to why we exist. Why does the parent want to be happy with the child? You know, here where I'm staying, there's a little two-year-old who's just basically adorable. The other day, she found 5 containers of baby powder and spread them all over her parents' bedroom and bed. Everything was covered in baby powder. When they found her, she said, "Me, happy!" You know, so even though the parents were a little... And the mother looks at her and says, "Me, not happy." But actually, at the same time, the parents were charmed. You know, why do we have children? To be charmed by them, to enjoy being charmed by them. That's why we exist. We exist because Krishna wants to be charmed by us. By us, by me particularly. Not just in general. Krishna doesn't just want to be charmed in general. Then why would I wouldn't need to exist? He wants to be charmed by me. And my happiness, my spiritual, unselfish happiness is being an instrument for Krishna to be charmed by me. That's the meaning of my existence. Now, I got to tell you something else. It's the mind that's saying, "Well, I can't do that because it's also selfish." That's the mind. Just like the mind says, "I can't be equipoised because then I'll be a chair." So the mind says, "I can't be working for Krishna to smile at me right now because it's still focused on me." All right, yeah, in the beginning it's still focused on us. But the more and more and more that I'm thinking, "I'm working so Krishna will be happy with me, I'm working so Krishna will be happy with me," then it becomes Krishna. But I never stop existing. I continue to exist as an individual with spiritual desires. And ultimately, that is my spiritual desire. If we want to boil it down, what is spiritual desire? It's that I am the instrument for Krishna's happiness. I am the instrument for bringing Krishna together with his pleasure potency. And that Krishna and his pleasure potency are therefore pleased with me. That's my Swadharma.
Very nice.
And there's this reciprocation that I'm trying to please them and they're trying to please me. And that goes on unlimitedly without either finding the end. They also, you know, Krishna and Radharani, they also want to be the instrument for my pleasure. That's, by the way, what gives them happiness, too.
Mother Vila, I was just curious. You mentioned 4 kinds of diplomacy. Did I miss something, or did you explain that?
I didn't explain it because I wasn't sure if I remembered it correctly. You can look... In the story of Prahlad Maharaj, where it's explained, I'll probably look it up for you, just to make sure that I'm getting it right here. Let's see. Prahlad. Don't we love having the database? One advantage of giving this class is that I can sometimes look things up. Okay, this is Bhagavatam 7.5.16, although I have seen people bring a computer to the Vyasa-san. Okay. 4 principles are used to suppress him. legal orders, pacification, the order of a post, or finally weapons. And there's no other arguments he is punished. Legal orders, pacification, order of a post, or finally weapons. Sometimes it also talks about, sometimes it's described differently. Sometimes Robert says the first thing, and I may not be able to exactly correct this, is flattery. Oh, you're such an important person. Why are you making agitation? Then the next thing is to offer them a post with an increase of salary. Or they call it being kicked upstairs. You know, become a vice president, get this salary, have this power. Prabhupada would do this. Bhakti Siddhanta would do this. Take troublesome disciples and give them a position of authority. And the next thing is to cause dissension in their own camp and finally punishment. So flattery, bribery, causing dissension in their camp, and punishment. Here, Prabhupada says legal orders, pacification, which I assume means flattery, the offer of post or finally weapons. So Prabhupada here is using legal orders instead of divine.
You know, I find especially with people that are more intellectuals, they're usually a little bit, they're more direct. And oftentimes I find that, at least those that I've come in contact with, they don't like even the word diplomacy. They see equate diplomacy with duplicity. There's no place for it in amongst honest people.
Well, that's because there's Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras.
So does that mean that amongst Brahmanas, then there would not be so much practice of diplomacy?
Of course.
Oh.
But if you're a Kshatriya or a Vaishya, then diplomacy is part of your seva. You better practice diplomacy. I had the misfortune a few weeks ago of being very straightforward with a Vaishya Kshatriya. Like Nanda Maharaj was king of the Vaishyas. So I had the misfortune of dealing with a devotee who was a Vaishya king in a very straightforward way. It was not pleasant.
Thank you.
That's not how he operates. He operates by diplomacy. He expected me to be diplomatic, and I wasn't. Bad move on my part. By trying to speak Chinese to a Russian.
You know what, Mother Ilma, I'm sorry. That call just came in for me. Sorry.
Okay, so what?
I'm sorry, Mother Ilma. Could it be just somebody, not because of the Varna ashram, but just people not ready to hear the truth for whatever reason?
Yeah, but Ramananda was speaking about in general.
Okay.
That... in general. But, you know, we each also have our individual personalities. And each one of us prefers tactfulness or truthfulness. And they each have their advantage. Some of us prefer being truthful over being tactful, and some of us prefer being tactful over being truthful. Mm-hmm. And neither one is actually more or less favorable for Krishna consciousness. It depends what circumstances. So really, the reality is that truth over tact is useful with some people in some circumstances, and tact over truth is useful with other people in other circumstances. Mm-hmm. But each of us have our preference. So we all know people who they prefer, or maybe ourselves, that we prefer to be tactful, and other people prefer to be truthful. Remember, those are two different aspects of the austerities of speech. Both are part of the S. One is supposed to be both truthful and tactful.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, you can't always do that. Sometimes there's just no way to speak tactful truth. It just doesn't work. You have to choose. So we usually, each of us as individuals, have a preferred choice. And if we speak to somebody whose preferred choice is different, then there's going to be problems. So one way to deal with this is to recognize what my individual preference is to be aware of the strengths and weaknesses of my individual preference. We tend to think our individual preference has only strengths and no weaknesses, and that everyone should be like us. Atmavan manyate jagat. I tend to think if I prefer tactfulness, then that's because it's far superior, and everybody should always prefer tactfulness. And I think if I prefer truthfulness, well, that's because it's superior, because, of course, I'm superior. And therefore, everybody should also always prefer truthfulness. But the reality is that sometimes truthfulness is better than tactfulness, and sometimes tactfulness is better than truthfulness.
Very interesting.
You know, so one should be aware, what is my preferred tendency?
Mm-hmm.
When, in what situations is my preferred tendency appropriate? In what situations is my preferred tendency not appropriate? If I'm in a situation where my preferred tendency is not appropriate, I can do several things. I can be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I can ask somebody else who has the opposite preferred tendency to deal with the situation. Or I can try, probably not very well, to adjust my preferred tendency intentionally. And most likely that'll be a little awkward. So the best thing I found, anyway, is if there's a situation that doesn't call for my preferred tendency, I have to be able to recognize it. I have to have the humility to recognize this is a situation where I'm not going to do very well. I'm not a good fit. I'm going to be a square peg in a round hole. It's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm either silent or I ask someone else to deal with it. If I have to deal with it, I may even apologize from the get-go and say, listen, I'm not really good at dealing with these situations, and I really hope I don't offend you.
Very nice. Wow, that's so helpful.
But this takes some honesty. And we have to know who we are and to realize that, hey, you know, what I am is the best in some situations, but it's not the best in all situations. Only Krishna is the best in all situations. No jiva has qualities that are perfectly suited for all situations. None of us.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be situations in life that call for qualities that we just don't have. And, you know, rather than pretending that everybody should be like us, we need to be aware of that. It's easy to say, hard to do. You know, there's plenty of times where I rush in doing things my own way and make a mess out of things, where really I should have stepped back and said, wait a minute, this is not a job for Amila, this is a job for somebody else, because I don't have any ability in this area, and I'll just mess it up.
Very nice. Thank you. It was so helpful. Wow. So many points you brought up about.
Okay, we should take one more.
Anybody? This is one of your last chances.
I'm giving one more class here after this.
Well, one statement stood out. I remember a situation years ago. Someone explained to me that Prabhupada, there was an Indian sannyasi, and he was going to create a problem for the movement. And he gave him a position, and he ended up running away with some money. So that understood that diplomacy, you know, whereas he now he has, what can he say? He's stolen some money from the movement.
Mm-hmm.
But kicking someone upstairs, you know, a troublesome devotee, making him an authority, doesn't that sound like trouble?
It can be. You know, I don't think it's ever easy, at least in my life experience. And if you have a different life experience, then I should be asking you this question. In my life experience, it's not easy dealing with troublesome people or enemies. You know, I've not found some sort of formula that always neutralizes troublesome people. And the funny thing about troublesome people is when you get rid of one of them, somehow another one pops up from somewhere. You know, it's like when you're a teacher, there's always one kid in the class who's the worst behaved. And if they leave the school, then all of a sudden you notice that the formerly second worst behaved becomes the worst behaved. So there's just no way to live a life without somebody who's opposed to you. Even God has people who are opposed to him and try to kill him and blaspheme him. So I don't think it's, you know, Krishna, he often just kills them. Although he tries to reform them as well. And dealing with difficult people is difficult. That's why they're difficult people. So I don't think that there's any way of dealing with difficult people that doesn't have some sort of consequence. You know, occasionally you may be able to deal with a difficult person quickly and easily with a minimum amount of consequence. But you have to decide for a difficult person, how are they going to cause more trouble? In a position of authority with some perks, or, you know, trying to throw them out entirely? I mean, if we look at a spiritual organization like ISKCON, so we find that there are many people who've been marginalized. Either the authorities have marginalized them or they've marginalized themselves, and they heckle from the boundaries. So, you know, would it be better to give those people some sort of a position rather than have them heckle from the boundaries? I don't know. You know, Prabhupada would do different things with different people, but I definitely know of a number of cases where Srila Prabhupada put difficult people in positions of authority. And sometimes, yeah, sometimes those people stole money. Sometimes they harassed the devotees under their care and caused a disturbance in the name of Krishna consciousness. But if you throw them out, they do that also. You know, if you throw them out of the society and they heckle from the sidelines, then they also be taking resources and people. So I don't know that there's some sort of a non-consequent, you know, a free solution, so to speak, for troublesome people. And if you discover it, please let me know, because I have a number of really troublesome people in my life. I love to find a way to deal with them that didn't have any consequences. Please let them. I've been looking for that for a few billion lifetimes, but I haven't figured it out yet. And, you know, I got a couple people right now who are, one person in particular, who's actively trying to cause a lot of trouble in my life in whatever way this person possibly can. And I've not found a way to neutralize it. That doesn't, everything I do to try to deal with this person causes more trouble. I've tried to ignore the person. I've tried to flatter the person. I've tried to cause trouble in their camp. What else have I tried to do? So many different things. I've tried to reason with them, give them some perks. And whatever I do, it's not working. And the person is becoming worse and worse and worse. And, you know, finally, under some very good advice, I just went to Krishna and said, look, Krishna, you're my protector. You deal with this because I can't deal with this. You're going to have to do what you want. And if you want this person to harass me, well, I guess they're going to harass me. What can be done? So anyway, you got any good hints, please pass them along because I could use them.
Yeah, that's the ultimate solution. Even the demigods, they're at a loss of how to deal with a particular situation. So they have to go to Brahma and ultimately to Vishnu.
Yeah, you know, I mean, even the demigods can't always deal with the demons. And Lord Brahma can't always deal with the demons. And, you know, when Hiranyaksha was causing trouble, he said, we're going to have to just let the Almighty Lord protect us. Lord Brahma tried giving them benedictions. Actually, I just thought of that, you know, giving them a position, because the demigods do that. Lord Brahma gives these demons positions and power. And then, I think it was Lord of Singhadev who chastised Brahma and said, stop giving benedictions to these demons. He said, you're causing trouble for me. Then I have to honor your benedictions and still get rid of these guys. So that happens even in the higher world where, you know, Brahma tries to get rid of, because Hiranyakashipu was causing a disturbance, right? And the demigods go to Lord Brahma and say, hey, this guy's causing a disturbance. And so Brahma says, okay, I'll go take care of it. So he goes down and sees Hiranyakashipu and he gives him a bunch of benedictions. He basically gives him a post of power. That's what he does. Okay, maybe now the guy will be pacified. I've got my power. Now I can be happy. But he's not. Then he goes on harassing the demigods even more than he was doing when he was doing those austerities. You know, and finally, Nisingadev has to do this trick because he can't interfere with Brahma's, well, he doesn't want to. He can, of course. He doesn't want to interfere with the laws of karma, and he doesn't want to interfere with Brahma's promises, so he can't just take away Hiranyakashipu's power. So he has to get Hiranyakashipu to break some universal rule that will allow for the Lord to interfere. So he arranges for Pilad to be born and for him to harass Pilad. And then he comes and he says, you know, Lord Ramah, stop making things difficult for me. Stop giving power to the demons like this. But yeah, I mean, what are we going to do? We're just little jivas. You know, if Lord Brahma can't exactly get it right, and he gives a position to a disturbing demon who just causes more disturbance. You never know. Sometimes you give a position to somebody, they're pacified and happy. I've had that experience many times. I remember we had a school board in North Carolina, and there was one person in the community that we knew was a troublemaker. And we put him on the board. And as long as he was on the board, he caused some trouble at board meetings, but he didn't cause any trouble in the community. Then one day he decided that he was going to give his seat on the school board to a friend of his, which was against the rules of the school board. You couldn't just give your seat to somebody else. And we said, wait a minute, you know, this is really a bad idea. But he just said, no, this is what I want to do. I'm resigning to the board. I want so-and-so to be on the board. As soon as this man was off the board, he was a troublemaker in the community. So there are some times when putting somebody in a position of authority removes them from causing trouble. And sometimes they cause more trouble. Now, it's hard to tell. Even Brahma couldn't tell. He thought giving Hiranya Kashyapu a position would get rid of the trouble. So you can try this and you try that, and you try the other thing, and after you've tried everything, while you're trying everything, you depend on Krishna for intelligence, and after you've tried everything, you go to Krishna, you offer your dandavats and say, Lord, I did everything I can, I give up. I've done, you know, I'm here as your servant. I've done everything I can according to the Shastra, and this person is still causing so much trouble for the Vaishnavas. You please protect us. Bahi Mampani. Okay. Thank you very much.
Could I get in?
Quick one.
Class on Tuesday, and then I will be leaving the islands. And then doing this will be very hard because I'll be traveling and I'll be in airplanes and different time zones during this time.
Mother Ermila?
Thank you very much.
Mother Ermila?
Yes.
Could you just give Mother Gandhari just 1 second? She wanted to say something. Mother Gandhari?
Sure.
Thank you so much. Sorry about that. You know, you brought up this very important point about different people's behavior, and this shows the mentality of people in different varnas and ashram. So the point is... that don't we normally in ISKCON, we have a habit of expecting everybody to be acting like a Brahman and pointing fingers. So now I'm so thankful that you did point out that diplomacy is a quality of a Kshatriya, and then we should not be so naive as to expect everybody to be acting as a Brahman. Is that correct?
I think there's a general Atmavan Manyate Jagat of all conditioned souls, that we think that whatever I am is perfect and everybody should be like me. And I think that's just a tendency. And that tendency also on an institutional level goes to there's only one kind of ideal devotee. And frankly, that's impersonalism. So, you know, we can't say what anybody else will do, but at least for ourselves, we should recognize that there are many different devotees, they have many different services to do, they're all needed. And just in order to do different services, you have to have various kinds of mentality. You can't be a manager unless you have a particular mentality. You can't be a scholar unless you have a particular mentality. To expect everyone to have the same mentality would mean that nothing could go on.
Thank you so much. This is excellent. Thank you for stating this. Thank you, Mataji. Haribo.
Yes,
and we don't have to see one mentality or one service as being better than the other. They're all needed.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mother Ermila, could you answer one quick question, please?
Yes, sure.
I'm going to miss you reminding me that I'm part of Lord Chaitanya's Leela right now, and I was wondering if there's anything I could read that would remind me.
In Chaitanya Charitamrita, yes, where the branches of the Chaitanya tree are described.
Thank you.
Where it is kind of a branch of the Chaitanya tree. So there you are.
Thank you.
One thing you can meditate on is just like, say, Narottama Das Thakur, who appeared after the disappearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And so Mahaprabhu is no longer physically manifest on the earth. But we still consider that someone like Narottama Das Thakur was participating in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's lila.
Okay.
So from a logical point of view, you don't have to have Mahaprabhu physically walking around on the planet, but visible to ordinary eyes.
Madam Mohan Prabhu, you wanted to say.
Thank you.
Two quick things. One is there's a saying to keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer. I've heard that. And then I had one quick question. If it's Vidura, did he remember or have the same knowledge he has when he's Mahajan the Lord of Death, Yamaraj? When he comes, does he still have that same kind of understanding and knowledge? Does it go with him?
I don't know. I would doubt it because it seems that Krishna uses a need-to-know policy.
Okay. Because I think, Lord Brahma,
you know, if we look at, like, people who get mystic power. So, you know, we've been reading that in the 11th canto with Ravindra Prabhu on Saturdays, that they can see everything and hear everything. They get a kind of omniscience. Of course, it's partial omniscience. But for participation in lila, that kind of omniscience is not generally helpful. You know, Narada Muni has it, but we don't find that the other participants in lila generally have that sort of omniscience. You wouldn't really be able to participate in the lila very well.
So it more or less went along with his job that he had in a different, when he was Yamaraj.
I would think so, because otherwise it isn't any fun. You know, have you ever been in a drama?
In a play?
Have you ever been an actor in a play?
I don't think so.
Not even when you were in school?
Perhaps.
So if you can try to think back to that, when you're in a play, in order to be a good actor, you've got to be absorbed in what that character is experiencing at that moment.
Oh, yeah, I remember a play I was in. It was in the fifth grade.
All right. So, you know, like, let's say you have to be absorbed in where the character is at that moment, or you can't play it convincingly. If when you're playing the character, you're aware of how the story ends, you're not going to be able to be absorbed in the drama. You know, could you imagine the residents of Vrindavan when Indra starts pouring rain and they say, oh, we know what's going to happen next. Krishna's going to listen over that hill. Yeah. We know the story. We know how it ends. And they just kind of sit down and say, all right, you know, let's see how it ends.
So he's the same person, but he gets a different part. So he may be typecast, but he doesn't have the same role. And the same information.
Right, so the devotee gets into the role that Krishna's given them. Even Krishna gets into his role. Even Krishna gets into that. Because otherwise it's not fun. Remember, this is play. When we were children, we used to play. So Krishna's always young. He's always engaged in Krita, in play. And under the spell of Yogamaya, everyone's absorbed in that play. No, we're not so much interested in becoming yogis with mystic powers. So when Yamaraj is Yamaraj, he needs to have a kind of limited omniscience. But as Vidura, he doesn't need to have that, and it would actually be kind of a disturbance.
But now as devotees, we have this knowledge which kind of gives us a bit of detachment from what's going on. So sometimes there's a little confusion. If you act just the way that you feel, your intelligence checks it to say, better to do it like this, and you get to pick three or four different how the story could go depending on what knowledge you imply.
That's true, but above knowledge and peace and neutrality is rasa. Rasa is above neutrality and above detachment. It includes material detachment. But one has to have material detachment as a prerequisite for developing rasa. Has to. You have to have, be at nishta before you can develop ruchi. Must.
As you were pointing out, you can't jump to these other stages. You have to go from where you are now. So it just seems like there's some awkward stages there.
There are, but there is a big difference between how we go through the stages as a bhakta and how one goes through the stages on the yoga ladder. So if one is going up through the yoga ladder, one is completely focused on attaining peace and neutrality and knowledge. One is not focused on bhakti at all. One's focused on peace and neutrality and knowledge. And after getting peace and neutrality and knowledge, one may try to develop bhakti. But Krishna advises don't do it that way. That first of all, it's very hard to get peace, neutrality, and knowledge separate from bhakti. Because you're having to work on something that's unmanifested. You're having to sacrifice for the Atma and for Brahman. How do you sacrifice for the Atma and for Brahman? It's kind of hard. You have to meditate on that which you can't perceive. How do you do that? And you've got no practical engagement for your senses. And then once you achieve it, as Prabhupada explains in 12.5, then it's hard to switch over to bhakti because you've been so used to just having peace and detachment. So the bhakti path is that one is doing things for Krishna from the beginning. And this is what's explained in text 10 of chapter 12. That even at the beginning, when I don't really feel that I'm in the lila and I'm not really feeling rasa, I'm still thinking I'm acting so Krishna will smile at me. I'm acting for that instead of for heaven. I'm connecting with Krishna immediately from the beginning, even though I haven't yet attained the platform of peace and detachment and knowledge. And by sacrificing the fruit of my activities for Krishna, I come to a peace and detachment and knowledge that is already intimately connected with Krishna. And the bridge from that kind of peace and knowledge and detachment to Abhyas Yoga, what we normally call Sadhana Bhakti, which is where I'm not only engaging my arms and legs and eyes in Krishna's service, but I'm constantly trying to engage my mind in Krishna's service, is a very easy and natural bridge. So on the one hand, I can't artificially jump. On the other hand, I am incorporating some level of bhakti from the very beginning. It may be an immature kind of bhakti. It may be a self-centered, you know, I may have so many problems with it. But I am incorporating a kind of bhakti from the very beginning. So as the beginning devotee, first day, I am meditating on how I'm part of Mahaprabhu's lila. And how I'm working so Prabhupada will smile at me and Mahaprabhu will smile at me. I'm doing that from day one. And I gain causeless knowledge and detachment as part of that bhakti. It's all one package. So I don't have to switch. It's kind of like a school where kindergarten through 12th grade is all in the same building. And maybe, you know, the way I used to run a school, you have the same teacher from when you're 5 to when you're 12. And the other way of doing it, you know, you go to an elementary school and then you all of a sudden have to switch to the secondary school. It's all different teachers and a whole different ways of doing things. And there's this big confusing transition period. So that's, if you go up the yoga ladder, it's like that. You've got to make a switch at some point. The process itself is unnatural. You have to make a switch. It's confusing. If you do it from Boston in the beginning, there is some period of difficulty when transitioning from Vaidhi Raganuga Bhakti, because it's kind of like going through puberty. But in general, it's a very seamless, natural process.
Thank you.
I hope that's clear.
I'll have to think about it for a while. It's nice.
If I was physically here, I could show you. I'm going to try to have you imagine something, actually do something. Take your hands, put them out in front of you, palm up. Now, take your right hand and put it up high. Okay, now what the yoga ladder does is you're going to move up with your left hand, and when you get to a certain stage of progress, you switch over to where your right hand is up and you go up over there. The bhakti process is that put your both hands like kind of in the middle. As you go down with your left hand, you're going to go up with your right hand. And Prabhupada talks about this gradually and proportionally. So what we're doing is we're gradually decreasing the attachment, material attachment, as we gradually increase the spiritual attachment. So every material attachment we let go of, we're immediately replacing it with a spiritual attachment.
Wow, that's a great example.
Okay, with the ladder, you're first getting rid of all your material attachments, and then you're trying to fill it up with spiritual attachments.
Wow.
So that's the difference. And you can see that the bhakti process is easier because you're always filled. You're always full. Whereas in the yoga ladder process, you have to become empty, and then you become full. So our bhakti process is not that I first wait until I'm completely peaceful, detached, and full of knowledge, and then I can start meditating on rasa and lila. That is not our bhakti process. Our bhakti process is I start meditating on rasa and lila from day one. I'm reading Krishna book from day one. I don't wait to read Krishna book until I've attained the Brahmabhuta stage. I'm dedicating everything to Krishna from day one. I'm dedicating Krishna from day one. So I'm still making step-by-step process, and I still have to be honest about what stage I am and how I'm going. But I can be meditating on Krishna even before I've attained the stage of knowledge and detachment. I can do that. In fact, I should do that. And that meditation will bring me to the stage of knowledge and detachment. Is that clear?
Yeah, that's really good. I keep thinking of that instruction by Rupa Goswami, to Rupa Goswami from Lord Chaitanya, where he says that there are four stages, which was Samatha, Diksha, Dhriti, and Dhira, where one base, that was the Shanta platform, the base of where it starts from, and the Sama was that he understood Krishna's basis of everything, something like Sabahatman Vasudev Sarvamiti, and then he's ready to tolerate his senses, and that's tradiksha. And then when he's tolerating, that's driti. And then after he's got it down where he's actually undisturbed, then he's dira. And it says that was the baseline for the shantaras. And from there, everything else progresses. But you're more or less saying you do that simultaneously.
Well, even the way you're describing it, even the base stage, you're connecting with Krishna immediately.
Yeah, the Sama was that started Vasudeva Sarvamiti. He concluded with his intelligence that Krishna is the basis of everything.
Right, whereas that Vasudeva Sarvamiti, that's the ending point for the yoga ladder. So the bhakti is starting at that point.
I guess that's it, yeah. Krishna.
I think
if we think that first I've got to become detached and knowledgeable, we'll, at least according to Krishna, we'll make our path harder. There seems to be a logic about it, which is why Arjuna asked that question in 12.1. He says, what's the best way to attain? You know, you said, yoginam api sarvesham, magatena dharatmana, shanamam bhajate yomam samayukta.